Episode 20 of The Exit Strategy. It's part two of the look back on 2022. Sebastian Ley back on The Exit Strategy talking about his latest article on The Figaro about inflation, what happened to the stock market in 2022. And with VC funding declining in 2022, we see consolidation in 2023 with a pickup in M&A. Now let's hear the count.
One, two.
You're listening to The Exit Strategy, a podcast that inspires open discussions about financial news and technology today. My name, Marcus Megarian, a recovering SaaS vendor, joined by my co-hosts, Ralph DeFiore and Swadek Mazumdar. And we're sitting down with startup founders, technology experts. Now let's begin. Because the most important thing about the podcast is that we're proud that Sebastian published, what, his 100th article now on Le Figaro and all these other French magazines. Yeah.
And a few in English too, you know. I would send you a few in English.
So what I mean, like, because we've been talking about the whole thing about the inflation thing, and you know, Sebastian, you it's your second time, and we brought you back on because you're the not only the former economic advisor to presidential candidates here in France, but you were talking about inflation, which was like a huge topic in the last half of 2022. And, you know, there's so many things that happen over the years. And last year we had things like decline in M&A activity, decline in VC activity, decline in whatever. We're seeing things about consolidation being played.
Yeah, of course, I'm full of a global economy, given my ties with the U.S. too. But yeah, the article was more precisely about France. I would like to start by saying that, truth be told, I was talking about inflation in 2019, 2020. You know, even over the last decade, we have an issue, you know, with spurring economic global growth, particularly here in France, and the question of inflation. And then in 2020, that was what we call here in France and in Europe, whatever it takes. It was originally from Mario Draghi, but Emmanuel Macron used the word because they pump up a lot of money, you know, with the ECB, very similar to the US. The issue is we never really got out of this exceptional mode, you know. So we had the pandemic, we invested a lot of money, a lot of public expenses, and then we never took the money back, and the inflation came. And so now what happened is that last year we began in Europe what I would characterize as a tight monetary policy, right? We began raising interest rates. In the US, the move started, remember, in March 2022. It was later in Europe. I think we are 4 to 5 months lagging behind the Americans. So it was over the summer that Christine Lagarde decided eventually, you know, to implement that tight monetary policy. And we're going to continue to increase interest rate, you know, in Europe, probably up until the summer of 2023. What happened specifically with France that is different from other countries and very different from the US is that in 2021, but more importantly in 2022, To this tight monetary policy, we actually associated a very expensive budget policy. In other words, we had a 4% deficit in 2022 in our budget. So we continued to inject tons of public money, while at the same time we were raising interest rates, which, if you open any economic textbook, doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, the essence of my article, of my analysis, was to say, hey, guys, it might be, we will see, you know, it might be that in 2022, we make, you know, that big specific mistake in France, and that we're going to pay the price of it in 2023, because the risk of that is that in 2023, you're going to have 6-7 months of rising interest rates. We're going to talk all together about the impact of rising interest rates, you know, on the economy, on tech valuation, on fundraising. But in the same time, because we have thrown so much bad money after good investments, then what we're going to have is that this inflation, you know, despite the rise in interest rates, is kind of self-sustaining. So if we increase interest rates, let's say to 4% in Europe, okay, presumably it would be less than in the US. And at the end of the day, you know, because you have budget deficit, your inflation is still at 4 or 5%. That's not going to be, you know, the place where we intended to be in the first place. So my fear and my analysis was to say, I can understand the social pressure in France because everyone is pretty much asking for money to the government. But it might be that all this we have done was to subsidize inflation, and that's it.
mean, Ralph and Swadok, you guys are in the East Coast, right? I mean, I'm in Paris. Ralph is in Florida. Swadok is in New York. I keep seeing these videos of people like saying, "This is what I spent," or "This is what I bought with $100." So they'll show this is their grocery shopping list. I've seen ones that were like, "This is my grocery shopping list in 1989, 2008, and today." What do you guys see in the East Coast that reflects what Sebastian is talking about?
Wow, I have to say, I see. Look, I read a lot, and there are indications throughout the economy that prices are going up. And I see it when my wife and I go shopping. Things we bought a year ago are up 30%. Certain items. But I mean, it's to be expected with the Federal Reserve and all the central banks pushing out money the way they did. And I'm sure that's what Sebastian's saying, that these central banks created a lot of monetary
Exaggerate that.
stimulus over the last dozen years. It's not only the last couple of years, it's the last dozen years, with maybe the last 2 years incrementally higher and greater.
I mean, I personally feel that when I was in college, I was in the engineering school, and I also did a major in economics. And there was this thing called the Fisher effect, which was basically the nominal interest rate was equal to the real interest rate plus inflation. And it's never, for the past 15 or so years, it's not followed that rule.
Well, actually,
So,
Marcus, ever since we've been working, the two of us, the Fisher rule never worked.
never
If
worked,
you
right?
checked, it has never worked.
Like you could read Adam Smith's
Yeah.
book. It doesn't even apply today. It's all about the rules are completely different. And the rules especially changed after the 2008 credit crisis, because you would imagine that with such high inflation, you'd have, the stock market going up like crazy. I mean, Ralph, you've done many IPOs, like 600 plus IPOs. I mean, doesn't inflation usually help in terms of the stock market going up?
Sure, it does, but to a point, and it de depends. If you let's say you have low growth environment, inflation will help things. If you have a strong economy like we had, then inflation is only going to make matters worse. Because the economy's strong, things are tight, supplies are tight. And don't forget, COVID caused all those supply chain problems, and you couldn't get certain materials and products. I have, as an example, I have some workmen here today, and they're installing hurricane windows, which I waited a year to get. And that's a function of how strong the housing market's been down here in Florida, but also the general economy.
It
So
sounds like Paris. I can't
but
even
it
get
also
a
shows.
it's all over the world, yeah. But I think what Ralph pointed out is that we were, I mean, the economy was already probably running, at least in the US, at full steam engine, right before the pandemic. And on that situation, we injected so much money that inflation was unavoidable. And to some respect, that kind of inflation is very different from what we had, let's say, in the 70s, right? I mean, I wasn't really around working, but I think we've been living in a very peculiar economic environment over the last 2 years. Well, and that was the essence again of my article. What I wanted to point out, and I think I did it for the US a few months ago, is that with the genius of hindsight, in a couple of months or years, we're gonna look at this period and say, hey, guys, we made some mistakes, maybe the politicians, but more importantly, the central banks. It might be that you know, the way we managed those last 2 to 3 years was not really optimal.
Swanick?
Yeah, so you'd asked about the East Coast. Obviously, other than just the core inflation, which has, you know, been there, we've seen definitely food and energy inflation as well, right? That has been tremendous, and that's hurting everybody's pocket. And you know, we spoke about on the last podcast, Marcus, we spoke about the Fed reading from December, so that's out now. So you know, they are not happy about what they see from the inflation point of view in 2023. They feel it's going to be much higher than what they'd expected. And the labor market is still very buoyant. So those two have to adjust, right? And so that's why I personally believe the market is reacting to that. Earlier on, the Fed fund is what, right? Four and a quarter right now. We were thinking the terminal value would be would be five. And now they're saying it should be even higher.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it was supposed to be 4.75, and it could be higher than five, right?
Five, terminal. Now they're saying it has to be higher. So we're obviously going to be looking at the Fed tightening further, much further than five, because the labor market is still very buoyant. You know, labor market is what, from 3.7 something, they're trying to bring it to about 4 or 5%, right? So we still have a way to go for that.
What they're saying, Swadik, is that by the time they're done with the tightening monetary policy, the unemployment rate should go from 3.6 to 5%. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, but
let me give you maybe a feedback on
they kind of drop you off after 6 months. So
let me give you maybe a quick feedback on the gauge or the level of inflation in France. The latest reading was 7%, which seen from the US could be seen as very good, but it's still increasing. And you've got to understand also that's the difference, you know, with that increase in inflation, because everyone was complaining in France, and because a lot of people in France, they expect, you know, the government to help them, to give them more subsidies, etc. The government invested the equivalent of 1.5%. of GDP just in new subsidies for fuel, for electricity, because of the impact of the war in Ukraine, etc. So all in all, you could say that the inflation in France is not really 7%, but more 8.5-9%. It's just that the gap, the difference, has been budgetized by the state and is pretty much paid by either debt or future taxes. Okay. But all in all, if you make a comparison with the US, it's pretty much the same level. And you will see maybe the only one difference here, if you compare to the US, is that we are paying even more when it comes to energy because of that other crisis, of course, with Russia and Ukraine. And then maybe if I compare, because I'm quite often traveling back to the US, I think that food prices are still a little bit lower in France compared to the US, especially the East Coast. You just go to a restaurant in Paris and in New York or Miami. And I was over the summer, you know, in the U.S. I still feel like Paris in terms of, you know, restaurant food, etc., is still a little bit cheaper than the East Coast.
I mean, there's a lot more controls here. I mean,
yeah, exactly. You're right, Marcus.
The thing is that, like, I mean, let's look at the numbers here, right? So you have overall inflation in the United States as of November has been about 6%, but if we include energy and food, we're hitting about 13%, right? Because food's about 10.6%, energy is about 13.1%, but all items combined are about 7%. We have in France, I mean, there's a lot more price controls, but what's really flowing out of this is that we're seeing a massive drop in the VC funding, right? So in the United States, if we've discussed this in the past about how we've had a decline in VC funding across the market, and that's basically we could attribute it to the increase in interest rates. That's because, like, you know, basic economics or basic corporate finance is that as rates go up, the risk-free rate increases, and it's kind of like the opportunity cost. It's like, should I invest on the 2-year bond? On the last podcast a couple days ago, we stated that the 2-year rate was about 4.7%. right? Swadek. And then we had the cost of capital when you invest in a fund is about 8%. Ralph, right? You work with a lot of these fees.
Yeah. What do you call it? A cost of capital? That's more your hurdle rate, right? It's your expecting rate of return. Yeah.
Because there's always the clawback situation, right? Because if you don't, one of your investments don't perform, you claw back from the previous one, and it's really an issue. It works differently with European funds or Brazilian funds than it does with the U.S. funds. But when we look at France, right, we haven't looked at a chart of like what's going on in France, and we see how funding has gone in France. In June, we had about 2.4 billion. And then we have today, in the last month of December, at 371 million. So we're talking about a massive drop. That's like, what is that? 1/5 the amount?
Yeah, 20%.
It's a huge decline. It's not that we're saying, I mean, in France, or in Europe in general, the interest rates have gone up less than they have in the United States.
Well, not exactly. I mean, the delta is probably as important as in the United States, but the threshold is lower because if you take treasury bond in France, the 10-year is at 3%, 3.1%. So obviously that's not the level of a U.S. government debt. But still, you got to remember that they went from almost zero to that level. So if you look at the delta, you know, the gap, it's still the same, because in the U.S. we never really the U.S. treasury debt yield never went below 1% like in France or in Germany. It was even negative in Europe.
Inflation is going up, interest rates are going up, VC funding is going down, right? What's the most important thing that happens? I mean, if price costs are going up, and then these startups all over the world that are dependent on venture capital money and getting a bunch of money into their pockets in order to pay for their growth, they don't. How do you guys feel about the possible fact that you might have consolidation over the next couple of months?
That's very simple, Marcus. Something has to give. You know, that's called something has to give in. That's called the exit. You know, but maybe we're gonna see a wave of forced exit just to finance these companies. You know, most of these companies, they still have great products. They want to develop these products. And so far, they were only thinking about, you know, VC money, easy VC money. It's not going to be that easy over the next 9 months, you know, over here in France. So they're going to have to go for another strategy.
And it's not just France, right? Because the European Union is very linked. So what happens? I mean, like, you know, Sebastian, you speak with a lot of guys here. There's a lot of we've discussed in the past that most of the M&A activity due to any kind of adverse reactions to the economy happens domestically. Mm-hmm. So what do we do to how? I really want to know. This is always the questions we ask. It's always like, well, how can we expose places like the United States to French organizations? Because there's so much opportunity here. I feel like this is one of the biggest pain points for a lot of these French companies. What happens? How can we improve this international cross-border fundraising? Or because I definitely know for a fact, and I've started speaking with many companies here about consolidation, and I explained to them, you don't always have to use cash to consolidate, right? You could do stock swaps and contract one another, and basically, you know, you guys merge, so 1 + 1 + 1 = 5. We discussed this in the last podcast. And this means that you could reduce your costs, you could improve, you reduce your inflationary issues, you reduce your labor costs, you reduce, but you benefit from the contracts you guys have within your companies. What do you think? I mean, like, what do you think that we should, what do you think is the fact that we should do to help French companies, or at least to have American companies work with French companies, I guess?
I think the French really found out about, you know, the startup scene and the tech scene, you know, only 10 years ago when they launched the French tech. And you know, Marcus, about the French tech, it's been a huge success. You know, the state did everything that has to be done, you know, for the tech startup, you know, to be to to really, you know, be successful, you know, at last in France. But because it's fairly recent, you know, I don't think that a lot of entrepreneurs, they still don't have this maturity, or this, they're just finding out, you know, with the first downturn cycle, pretty much, ever since the French Tech was launched, what it takes, you know, to take a startup, you know, from scratch to a successful exit, or really, you know, the conquest of another market, like the US market. So over the last years, the issue is that they've been sold kind of a dream or a myth about, you know, the tech entrepreneur that could be only, you know, on his domestic market, raise money from a French state, that there would always be tons of money, that things were easy. They had an easy life. They had a very easy life. They had a good growth between 2016 and 2019, when they had low interest rates. They got scared with the pandemic, but that lasted, you know, maybe 2 to 3 months, and then they realized that the state will always be here. So it's only now that they are beginning to realize what a downturn really is. You know, most of these guys, they never went through the internet crash, you know, the dot-com crash of the early 2000s. And so they're just learning by doing, you know.
But I want to state that they had an easier time, because the problem in the United States is that most people require these crazy high salaries, crazy high expenses. It's all about spend. So in European startups, and having worked for European startup as a SaaS vendor, it's less cost expense, less craziness versus working for a US organization. But at the same time, what's happened then, and we're talking about a group like Chatsworth establishing a European office, we speak with a lot of C-level people. We only speak to C-level people. It won't work if we speak to the associates or the low-level guys. So the inflation in the price tag that they expect also reaches a level that is starting to become American, despite the fact that the labor cost or the cost of operation is still significantly lower than the United States.
Well, it's the impact of globalization. You know, the tech entrepreneur in France, they can read, you know, the success stories in Fortune magazine or Forbes. And so they want to get similar exit as the one that you can see in the US. With that being said, when it comes to not exit, but VC valuations, you still have a gap between the US and France. I could take a lot of example why, you know, startups with similar product. The only issue is that, you know, the small European guy is going to get killed by the US guy, just because, you know, the valuation rounds are not the same. And so the US team has a lot of money to spend. And you're right, the culture of money is not as profligate, you know, in let's say in France, especially if you leave Paris, as opposed to New York. I spent 10 years in New York, so I remember that sort of crazy expenses. I'm less familiar with Silicon Valley, but I'm assuming it's the same. With that being said, in a very fast growing market where no one is paying attention to the bottom line, maybe you want to spend. Maybe, you know, maybe some of the European entrepreneurs, they're not bold enough, they don't spend enough to capture, you know, their competitors' market. Maybe that's an advantage too for the US companies, don't you think so?
Well, France, I know when we talk with CES 2023 happens.
Okay.
It starts
now,
in 2 days.
Tomorrow. Yeah, two
right.
days.
Tomorrow, right? Actually, January 5th, tomorrow. So
I wish I could be there.
I wish too. But
we should go next year together to Vegas. Well, we're gonna schedule that.
So we have a guy, one of our guys is on the floor tomorrow. We're speaking to him on Friday in 2 days. And the fact is that when I look at the floor plan for the international companies going there, France has one of the biggest footprints. Like it's so huge compared to the other things. Netherlands has one big square. France has like 12 or 15. It's massive. And then the Touch have like one big one. The Japanese, the Koreans, they all have very small footprints compared to the French.
I'm surprised France has such a big footprint compared to, say, Japan, because it's CS is mostly technology, electronics, right? So Japan is very big in that. But Marcus, I want to definitely go back to your question about VC funding drying up, you know, slowing down in 2022. I don't think it's drying down for the lack of opportunities or dry powder. There's plenty of that. But what Sebastian mentioned was valuation, right? the valuation still has not reset, and that has to still reset. Once that reset, you know, I think you will see those, you know, those investments happen. From a valuation cultural point of view, what Sebastian also said, one of the biggest metrics that U.S. companies look at is the TAM, the total addressable market. When it's a French company, they look at it very, very differently than how we look at it. And that measure really converts or translates into a different valuation metric.
Exactly. If the TAM is a purely French or European market,
exactly,
there's no way that you can reach the same valuation as opposed to people or my
correct.
Friends in New York or Silicon Valley or Miami. When they launch a startup, it's always a global startup. Here in France, I'm always pestering after them, telling them, even though you start your company here with good French engineer, your engineers, your market should be global, you know, and except maybe the Web3, you know, the crypto/metaverse guys who are even here in France pretty good at doing this, you know, like targeting global market. But in other subsectors like SaaS, etc., I still see some people, you know, pretty much coding software that are only in French or only addressing the French.
Yeah, we spoke about that last podcast, Marcus, with Hans, I think, right, on Brazil.
Yeah.
That why would companies?
So frustrating.
Yeah, why would companies do that when, you know, you have a global market to address?
No, it's because they send us like all these data rooms in Portuguese, and I'm just like, nobody speaks Portuguese outside of Brazilians and Portuguese and some like people that have hype in the country. But you know, I go to people, it's like, if the LPs speak a language, that means the VCs speak the same language, so you better speak the same language as limited partners, you know. So look, so here, I mean, so I mean, I'm gonna share my screen. I'm obviously gonna have to do this later, but this right here,
oh. Yes.
Is everything here. This is the Dutch right here, the NL Tech, right? Mm-hmm. That's the entire Dutch community. This is all French right here, 16 booths. There's a lot. There's Korea here, Korea International, Samsung, etc. France is kicking butt. This is
Israel. Marcus, let me tell you one thing. To get back to what I was saying about, you know, the story of a tech industry in France, the startup scene. 10 years ago, no one in France was going to Las Vegas. Absolutely no one.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it's a matter of, you know, the government, you know, taking reins of that and sending, you know, massive delegations to Las Vegas, because even here in France, there's a lot of communication about, you know, La French Tech, Business France. You know, that's the booth you're showing right now. So yeah. So it's a lot of government money. They have identified, you know, a few events in the U.S., including that one. And they're spending a lot of money on that at long last. But they're playing a catch-up game, and it's good, you know. I strongly encourage that, but it's a catch-up game. We're investing money for this year, but also what we didn't do, you know, 10 years ago.
But many of these companies are not what people think about what would be at CES, right? It's
yeah.
It's not analytics. It's not like payment tech. It's stuff like water treatment or
yeah.
renewable
clean
energy.
Clean tech, a lot of clean tech.
Like
yeah.
stuff that you, like even things like clean water distributors for offices.
Yeah. I spent the weekend, Marcus, in the south of France, in Aix-en-Provence. And I on Sunday, I opened a local newspaper. You had five, I mean, it's Aix-en-Provence, right? It's not a big city. You had five startups only from Aix-en-Provence going to Las Vegas with the French government and French BPI, yeah. You know, the public investment bank.
So, I mean let's be straight. We know that the market in France, we've discussed this for more than 6 months on the exit strategy. There's a lot of cash being distributed to companies. There is a definite need, and there's too many companies doing the same thing. Interest rates are going up. We definitely expect companies to consolidate in the near future, right? And it's not just France. It's not just the United States. It's India too. I mean, like it's when you have too many people doing the exact same thing, economies don't function when everyone's doing the same thing. You know, everyone would love to be Facebook or a Google, right? Because it's pretty simple. I mean, what do you do? Oh, I do searches. What do you do? Oh, I do social media. If you are the definition of a vertical, everyone wants that position, you know, so it's not the fact. So what happens now with the consolidation play? How do we consolidate the market? Because France, 80 to 90% in the United States is the same. It's not so different. India, I'm going to imagine it's the same way. Most people, you have 20 companies that are doing the same thing in analytics or in payments or in digital banking. You know, we are definitely going to see consolidation. Now, when does it start? When, how, I mean, I know what's going to happen because for us as what we do day to day, it's 100% what we look forward to, but it's the action or the economy that's going to force people to do it. But the difference is that it becomes our responsibility to make sure we attain the proper letters of interest or the LOIs. And then it becomes choices that people have to make that impact their employees' lives and their company's lives.
Well, if I can take that one, Marcus, first of all, my gut feeling is that entering into a more complicated period for the global economy, a lot of people that were potentially thinking about an exit, you know, when comparing, you know, with fundraising options, they might be a little bit more willing to listen to the investment banker. You know, that's really the first point. And that happened in tech in the early 2000s. That happened, you know, in 2009, 2010. So it's going to be, it's all a deja vu again, you know, and it should be in favor of more consolidation. A second thing that I want to mention is that why, as a US company, should you want to buy in France? And of course, most people are going to say it's the market. I want to launch my product, you know, in France. I want to get customers in France. To me, that is not, that could be the case sometimes, but that is not the man in Paris, you know, for M&A, for transatlantic M&A. I think that, and maybe a lot of Americans are not aware of that, or maybe I'm just bragging about France, but I feel like by buying into France, into French startups, you're buying into a lot of creativity, great engineers. I know that everyone, when they think about France, they're thinking about Emily in Paris, you know, luxury, fashion, wine, etc. But you, Marcus, you really know France, right? You know that we have excellent engineers. You know the story of our industry, etc. Might not be obvious from the Silicon Valley, but you have tons of good technologies, tons of good people, you know, that you can actually acquire or work with in France. And that should be the main impetus for acquisitions of startup, you know, in France. And more importantly, you can do that at much more decent valuation when as compared to finding another US companies, you know.
I know the answer to your comment.
Yeah.
Most French investment banks don't have the FINRA SEC license to solicit their companies.
Exactly. And that's another point. Yeah, that's another point.
Ralph, as the compliance officer, you know what happens if you start doing something against the
that
the
what you're saying is much more down to earth, but that's a fair point. I'm giving that one to you.
It's not pretty. Let's say that.
What happened? Like even Kim Kardashian, she felt the rage. You know, like it was the all she did was post it on Instagram. You know, there was an article posted by a French newspaper about Emily in Paris, where she mm-hmm. to live the life that she actually did. Because like they were saying, like, okay, she probably makes 35 to 45,000 a year, but the lifestyle, the apartment she has, and the clothing she wears, she's spending at least $120,000 post tax. So that life is 100% impossible. Yeah, it came out like a month ago because I think season 3 came out.
I know, but Marcus, is it more stupid than what we thought of New York? You know, we in Europe when we were watching Sex in the City, you know, in the late 90s, that was pretty much the same. When I arrived,
I feel
York,
that Sex in the City original season 1 is much more realistic than the new Sex in the
you
City.
You might be right.
I'm just saying.
But still, you know, as a newcomer to New York, I remember, you know, telling myself, "Wow, that thing was not realistic because how could they live in that city? You know, it's so expensive, etc." Same thing with France, by the way.
But that's exactly what I tell a lot of CEOs here in Europe. It's like, you know, you could say your company is worth so much. It's always a very simple thing. What is the result that you like? If you want the result, you say, this is what your company does today. This is what its value. And then you say to yourself, do you, if you want to sell, this is the price you get. And I tell people very clearly, everybody who I talk to, they tell me my company's worth 10, 20, 30X. I go to them. Have you received a letter of intent, an offer with the bona fide signature and all that stuff? 100% of the time, when they tell me some crazy number, they've said never. I've never received an offer signed and written down. It's always whiskey talk. But
Marcus, we have a funny story at the firm in the heyday of the dot-com era. We had a client come in and we said, we think we can get you a $12 million valuation. They said, we want to start at $40 million. I mean, you could see just how many multiples over what we thought was a fair valuation. And our banker said, why do you want to start there? They said, well, we want to negotiate down. And he said, well, why don't you start at $100 million? Short story long, they left us and they were bankrupt 6 months later, you know, because they never got the financing.
I think we're going to see, by the way, similar stories. You know, if we're trying to talk about the trends in 2023, I think in a couple of months, we're going to talk about some unicorns that maybe didn't want to be acquired, you know, last year, that are going to go bankrupt, you know, unicorns and maybe some SPAC merge companies, you know, in the EV, clean tech or tech sectors. It's going to be deja vu all over again, you know, similar to the early 2000s.
What's frustrating,
Sebastian, is it your impression in France that there is a lot of debt, that companies are loaded up with debt, that financial institutions have a lot of debt, that consumers have a lot of debt? Is that your impression? Or?
Okay, I'm going to go sector by sector. Consumer, certainly not, except real estate. We had a huge real estate boom, but it's all fixed rate. But still, you know, it's going to be, it might hinder a little bit mobility, you know, because people are going to be stuck with huge mortgages. Startup, no, because by definition, startup, they're not using a lot of debt. And you don't even have venture capital debt, you know, in France. It's not so common. We very often have these conversations with Marcus. But still, we have a huge LBO / private equity sector that is loaded up with debt, sometimes floating rates. So with the increase in interest rates and financial institutions that are going to be more conservative, that is going to be an issue. So I do not expect a repeat of a huge credit crisis of 2008. But still, you know, you're going to have some issues, some difficulties, you know, in the classic industrial sector, just because of a burden of debt. Financial institutions, banks, they're not as well as capitalized as in the US. But if you take the example of France, you don't have that many banks. You know, it's a couple of huge, you know, huge giants. So they're kind of too big to fail and very well supported, you know, systemically, you know, by the system and by the government and the central bank. So again, you know, what I do fear is that in 2023, you're going to have a mix of a dot-com crash and a 2008 crisis. And it's not going to be as huge as 2000. And on the credit side, it's not going to be as important as 2008, but it's going to be in between. And so the final outcome is going to be pretty, pretty nasty, you know, in terms of what we're going to go through the 2023 year in Europe, in Western Europe.
I think what you have now is like the credit crisis, but with equity.
Exactly.
But with equity, it's like you sum up what I said. Yeah,
credit crisis plus equity pull down.
Now there's a firm I respect. They're called Hoisington, and gentlemen there, Van Hoisington and his partner Lacey Hunt, who's an economist. They've been long, that is, buying long dated bonds since 1983, when U.S. Treasuries were yielding 14%.
Yeah,
and so I have a lot of respect for them because I know they've been buying long bonds throughout the bond bull market. Of course, it's turned around, but their opinion is that the world is so loaded down with debt that interest rates can't go too high because it's going to crush the economy. You know,
yes,
that
I
that
agree.
That's good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree, but the question is, where's the threshold? I mean, in the U.S., I mean, mortgages are already at like what, 6.5%, right? So treasury debt is going to be at 5%. So we're already kind of high. But I agree with you. I really doubt that we can get back to the situation in the 70s, you know, with double digit interest rate. And that's because of the existing debt burden. If we go too high, it's going to kill the system anyway.
Yeah. Just look at the U.S. government. What it would start to
be
pay.
Bankrupt. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to put a positive spin to all this. With the way the interest rate is, with the valuation on the VC, and I'll just, you know, kind of just hone in on the VC landscape. Valuation will be moving forward much more realistic than frothy. It will not just be, let's get market share and use those metrics to create some valuation. It's also going to be, how soon can you have profitability? And so, you know, and we see those cycles come in again and again. Every 10, 15 years, we see that. And that's coming in. And opportunities, Marcus, you and I spoke about them in the last podcast about how these opportunities are waiting in the wings to be funded, and they will be funded, and there'll be so many opportunities that's going to come out of this downturn that are going to create more jobs and going to create, you know, more exciting technologies that we haven't even thought about.
Well, I know that in the next podcast we're having someone live at CES, and what I want to say about that is that seeing the real economy and what's actually happening in the market is going to be a telltale sign about how people are feeling, because the fact is that, like, it's one thing to talk about statistics and numbers, but what a business is actually doing is a very, very, very important thing. So let's do this. We're gonna call the podcast today, but we definitely want to thank Sebastian for his time here. And, you know, I mean, Sebastian, give us your final thoughts on anything that we should expect over the next quarter.
Well, maybe, you know, to go with Swadik, you know, positive spin, I would say one of the difference, you know, that I see in this downturn, in this global downturn, is the astonishing amount of public spending. So, you know, over the next 2 to 3 quarters, maybe as a venture capitalist or investment bankers, look at the startup, you know, or the subsectors that can profit, let's say, in the U.S. from the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, the tax 45 credit in France, you know, what we call France Relance, it's 30 billion euros that are going to be invested in several tech subsectors or clean tech. That is going to sustain all those startups, even, you know, if there is some sort of a VC complicated death valley over the next months. So please have a look at the public sector. Maybe have a look at politics, you know, and what these people are saying and what kind of industries they want to support over the next 10 months.
Marcus, I want to definitely echo something Sebastian said as a closing. You know, his article, you know, we were talking about catastrophe. It'll be catastrophic if we have inflation in 2023. I think we're past that. I think we are now thinking about recession. But more than that, I think something that really stood out, which he mentioned, was that we must start reducing our deficit and our public spending. That's where I think the biggest, the biggest culprits are.
Look, for me, deficits started back in 2008 during the credit crisis, and that was all built up for years before that, since like Community Investment Act of Bill Clinton of 1995, because that's how we started pumping everything up. Geez. And then we just kept pushing things forward and forward. Look, in the end, we know that we have to look at things from a short-term perspective, but also a long-term perspective. And on the exit strategy, what we're trying to figure out, it's we could tell you what the exit strategy is. We can't force the founder to exit at the price that we tell them that the company's worth at. It all comes down to mutual agreement. And as Sebastian said on this call, was that a lot of times companies go under because nobody agrees. 6 months later, goodbye. So let's call it. Guys, thank you so much for everything. Sebastian, Ralph, Swadek.
It's thanks for having
good to
me.
Have you guys.
Take care, guys. Good conversation.
Thank you.
Episode 20 of The Exit Strategy. We hope you liked it. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe. We hope to see you in episode 21.